Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, our guest is Tom Anderson. Tom is the vice chairman and founder of Pensco Trust Company and Pensco Inc. He's considered by many to be the national expert, author, and speaker on the topic of self-directed IRAs and plans. In addition, Tom focuses on how investors can increase their wealth-building potential with real estate and private equity investments. He's written articles for nearly all the nation's financial magazines and was recently invited to Washington as part of the Future of Finance initiative to assist the Obama administration as they create new rules for the lending world. Tom, welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce. It's a pleasure again.
We had just talked about the idea of an IRA making an investment and then having something go wrong, and you can loan your personal funds to assist that. Go ahead and give me the kind of the terms in the situation that that's allowed.
Yeah, there's some really unusual terms unless you understand some of the more obscure laws. But basically, you can extend the loan regardless of term, but they generally recommend it be no more than 5 years. But you can loan money to your IRA in the case of falling short to make a property tax payment or a mortgage payment on a IRA-owned asset, provided that you're protecting basically the existence of the IRA or assets in the IRA, and you're not like putting $40,000 in there to buy another lot, for example, or a new investment. So it has to be sustain the operation of the existing assets. And in addition, it can't bear any interest rate. It has to be interest-free, because if it did have a rate, it would be considered self-dealing because you'd be paying yourself, you know, a profit out of your IRA. And because of the rules, that's just the way it is. So it has to be interest-free. And lastly, if the loan extends more than 60 days, then you have to provide the custodian with a note, written note saying the IRA as the debtor owes you personally XYZ money. And those are the only provisions. And I actually had a conversation with a senior member of the Department of Labor who would be interpreting the use of this kind of exemption, who created the exemption, in fact. I gave them the example of that scenario where somebody had a property, the mortgage on it, and they couldn't make the mortgage payment. And I said, would that be an example where you could take advantage of this exemption? And he said, exactly. That's exactly one of the reasons it was developed.
Okay.
So, I have a pretty high authority that that's why it's there.
Now, I read this this sentence in your book that you contributed to, on a good day. That's scary.
Yes.
On a good day.
Yeah, that was a fun little story. Maybe I'll repeat it just for...
I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I had a fellow call me with was a Merrill Lynch broker with a client, and he said, look, I got a fellow here. He wants to use his retirement account to buy a brand-new Ford GT special car. It's something like a $150,000 hot rod. I don't know enough about cars, but in any case, it's a very unusual car, and this is a couple of years ago. And he thinks it's going to depreciate because it's a limited edition. He just wants to hold it for appreciation. Can he do that? And I thought about it for a while. It's not on the list of what are otherwise called collectibles, which are mostly things like stamps, artwork, antique rugs, certain coins, things that more typically are viewed as collectibles. But there is a catch-all in the language that says, or anything else the U.S. Treasury Department deems to be a collectible. So I got on the phone, called somebody in the Department of Labor and said, look, here's the scenario. What do you think? And he said, well, on a good day, we would say that's okay. But on a bad day, we'd say he's probably going to drive that car to the concourse to Elegance and on the weekends. And that's self-dealing, so we'd say no. And I said, well, why don't you call another expert over in the IRS, who I happen to know personally, and see what he has to say. And I called him, and he said pretty much the same thing on a good day and a bad day. And I called a fellow back from Merrill Lynch, and I said, you know, on a good day and a bad day. And then we all laughed. But
I guess
there are those that you can actually have the position on a matter changed from who's deciding in the government that day or that week, although they tend to collaborate, but also in terms of which way the wind is blowing in the government and in terms of abuses.
That's a little scary. Well, you know, probably the most appropriate question to ask then is at the very beginning, is this a good day?
Well, yeah. One of the things that our company does, and we sort of consider ourselves a knowledge leader, and actually it's my goal now within the Retirement Industry Trust Association is to take a leadership position in helping to inform the public of not only their options, but the potential risks that are associated with doing the wrong thing with your IRA. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I contributed to this book that's now out, which is primarily focused on leveraging your IRA, using, you know, leverage to improve the yield. But we do cover a number of the other issues like prohibited transactions, just to help, you know, get the word out to people that, yeah, you can do incredible things and have vast opportunities with your IRA. Just have to watch out from, you know, to avoid doing something that the government would deem to be a prohibited transaction, because then you lose the tax-deferred status of your retirement account and you could be subject to penalties and taxes.
Well, let's talk about that. My company invests in real estate, buys and sells it predominantly. We have some rentals, but the business is basically set up to buy and sell. So let's say that I had enough money in my Roth IRA to buy and sell property. Is there a limit? Is that...
Well, you know, this is, again, up to interpretation, but there's a point. First of all, there's no limit as to how many times you can do that. The only question is whether or not during a period of time, whether or not you would be considered running a trade or a business, which would create a taxable situation for your IRA. If you actually own a gas station or a pizza parlor or a real estate development company or a real estate lending company, effectively, through your IRA, then like any other business that pays taxes, the IRA has to pay a tax. But if you're strictly doing it as an investor, and let's just give you an example. If you're fully employed at IBM or whatever on an 9-to-5 basis, and you're doing investing on the side in real estate, even if you're pretty active, it would be hard for the government to say that that's your business. It's not much different than somebody that goes to work at Goldman Sachs all day long and then every night goes home and buys and sells stocks. So you could make that argument. But on the other hand, if you're retired, unemployed, or whatever, and you're very active with your IRA and buying and selling real estate, then people could, you know, make the argument that that's your sole, you know, business, and you are subject to tax on the gains. So basically, you know, we would recommend that when you're starting to get active, and particularly if you're not employed in something beyond what the IRA is doing, that you consult with your own CPA to see whether or not you'd be subject to a tax.
On a good day, will you get different answers from those CPAs?
Oh, absolutely. Depends on what CPA you can buy, and a more expensive CPA and get a better answer.
Or at least a different one.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Geez, that's a little scary, but you're right. That's exactly the way it is. Okay, let's talk about prohibited transactions,
sure.
Because sometimes investors can get creative, so we might as well figure out what we're not supposed to do and
right
up front. So, what's a disqualified person?
Okay, that's a good question, and it reflects that your understanding, which is great. Disqualified person is a term in the government code, specifically something called Internal Revenue Code 4975, which defines that, you know, certain individuals and certain entities as being disqualified persons, which means people that you can't deal with or entities you can't deal with your IRA. And when we say deal, we mean having a transaction with. So, typically people who think about real estate think about making personal use of the real estate that they own. So if they want to buy a condo in Cancun, they expect to be able to go down and vacation there, even if their IRA owns it. Well, unfortunately, the rules are set up really to... The design was that you can't touch your IRA assets because the government wants them to be there when you retire. And therefore, they lock them up until you retire and put constraints on them, and specifically limiting your ability to transact with them. So the disqualified persons that are individuals include yourself, your spouse, your children, and your parents, and virtually anywhere up the chain or down the chain of ascendancy or descendancy, as well as the spouses of your children. Now, interestingly enough, brothers and sisters are not disqualified persons.
Yeah.
The spouse of your daughter is, or your son, and therefore, you know, my theory is that the guy who wrote the code was an only child, didn't know what his sibling was, but would never know. But anyway, they're not disqualified. However, when you do deal with a sibling or a nephew or an uncle or whatever that isn't otherwise a disqualified person, it's still advisable to do it at market rates so you're not falling into another trap, which is dealing with a judgment clouding person. That is, you're not getting the best yield for your IRA because this is somebody you have a personal interest in, and therefore you're giving them a deal, and that's not going to be acceptable either.
There was an example in the book that was just a little scary because it seemed like the intent could have been perfectly pure. Uh-huh. There was a guy that owned a commercial building, and his IRA owned the lot next door, and he was parking on the lot.
Right.
Somehow,
exactly.
Somehow that's personal use?
Well, sure. He's not paying otherwise to get a, you know, personal. He's getting a personal benefit by using his IRA-owned property as opposed to paying for parking from some other party. But it's not so much. Well, one of the it's called the exclusive benefit rule. The only person or thing that should benefit from an IRA transaction is the IRA. Now, indirectly, as the beneficiary of the IRA, you're going to benefit because you have a nice big fat IRA when you retire. But during the time it's growing, you can't get a personal benefit from transacting with it or interfacing in any way. So if this guy's using his IRA property, whether it's parking on it or putting his medical building on top of it, and which we've also seen, that's self-dealing. You can't do it. And again, you know, the funny thing about a lot of this is when I speak and when we talk about this or even write about it, people think that we're making the rules or I'm making the rules. We're just communicating the rules and trying to keep people out of trouble. And they are what they are. And we can all complain about them, but we can also look at the glass half full approach and say, look at all the things you can do without getting in trouble.
Absolutely.
You didn't know you could do until you read the book or you came to a presentation.
And if somebody crosses over a line, and not even intentionally, just unintentional. Is there a slap on the wrist and say, okay, don't park there?
No, you have 14 days to correct it.
Oh, good. Okay, you do.
If you enter into it, but if you go beyond that, you know, the only hope you can have is to get a good lawyer to argue with whoever it is, the IRS, the Department of Labor, that, you know, you didn't actually create one. But, I mean, they're not going to just forgive it.
Okay.
They won't. But if somebody else either made a mistake, let's say the custodian made a mistake and you can establish that was the case and you didn't, then you have a good argument that you shouldn't suffer, they should, or whatever.
But, let's talk about the role of a custodian then, because that sounds like that's real important.
Well, yes, it is, absolutely. In fact, as the president of this Retirement Industry Trust Association, I'm sort of proud of the fact that I was initiated a change to our bylaws to eliminate any members that weren't regulated institutions, because as this industry is growing, more and more people are entering it, some of whom are not good characters, or, you know, some companies just without that oversight from a regulatory body can just inadvertently create some problems for themselves and their clients. So we won't accept any member that is not a regulated institution, and it goes a long ways, particularly in banking, not so much in the securities industry, as we know from experience over the last few years. But, you know, you don't see too many banks being shut down for fraud or those kinds of things. It's more because, you know, they've had an economic downturn or whatever. But making sure that if you're dealing with a company that may not be a brand name, and there aren't too many brand names in our field, that you can get substantiation from them, evidence that they are regulated, because many will say they're regulated, I'll give you an example. There was one custodian, which happens to be still out there. Actually, they're not even a custodian, but they claim that they were, and that's part of the problem. But it's a firm out there with essentially billions of dollars in retirement assets, and they used to say that they were regulated and audited annually by the IRS, Department of Labor, Franchise Tax Board, and all that kind of stuff, all of which was not true. And they got away with just saying that until somebody saw that, and now they have to make a disclaimer to say that we're not regulated by any state or federal authority, which is quite a 180.
Now, if so, if they weren't a custodian, then what hat did they fit under?
Well, basically, it's just like a dry cleaner. They just opened up a business, and that what they did is they got an agreement with a bank that was a custodian. All banks in the United States and credit unions, savings and loans, trust companies are automatically qualified to hold IRAs. If you're not one of those institutions, then you have to be separately authorized and accepted by the IRS. So, for example, believe it or not, Merrill Lynch and Schwab are regulated by the IRS and have to apply to them to get the ability to offer IRAs. In fact, my company, in years past, actually served as custodian for other broker-dealers that weren't so licensed. So there's about 257 mutual fund companies, insurance companies, and broker-dealers that are licensed by the IRS. And there are thousands, probably, of others that are in those same businesses that are not authorized to hold IRAs because they didn't apply.
Is a custodian there to help you decide if a transaction is legal to do within the IRA?
Well, in the self, it's sort of a conflict with the idea of self-direction. However, I can tell you that since I'm in the process of developing best practices in the industry with our association, we're taking the posture that it's not only good business for us, but it's good business to protect the consumer. And that's being reflected more and more, by the way, from the government in terms of their view of these things. That regardless of whether they are telling us to do it or not, if we know that they're going to enter into a prohibited transaction, we're just not willing to do it, period. We'll tell them what we know, and if they can somehow establish that we're mistaken with good evidence, we'll certainly modify our view. But if we are convinced that the transaction itself would constitute a prohibited transaction, we're either going to decline it or we're going to resign as a custodian.
If, let's say, a lender was involved in what turned out to be a prohibited transaction, are there any ramifications for them?
Yes. They would have to pay, if they're not the IRA owner and they're involved in creating a prohibited transaction for an IRA owner, then they would be subject to an excise tax on the amount of the transaction, which I think is 15% of the amount.
So a lender that made a 100 grand loan would be getting a 15 grand bill?
Yes, and there wouldn't be any effect to the customer unless they were involved and were aware of the violation and were a conspirator to it. But if they were not aware and it resulted in a prohibited transaction, then it would just be that party that created it.
Okay. Again, I'm around a lot of very creative people, so I really like this example. So give me an example of a preconceived quid pro quo.
Well, this happens all the time because, again, like you said, people get creative and they're always looking for workarounds. And when you tell them that they can't buy a property from themselves, and they say, well, what if my buddy uses his IRA to buy my property and I use my IRA to buy his property? Can we do that? And, the answer is no. That's considered either a linked or what they call step transaction by the IRS, which means that the intent was to violate the rule, but you found a way to mask it by, creating a quid pro quo with some third party. So if, you can go all the way to Afghanistan and back and through South Africa with your transaction, but if the thing was all designed to come back to square one and to have you get a personal benefit as a result of your transaction, it's still a prohibited transaction.
Any big deal with the penalties for something like that?
Well, what size suit do you wear? Do you like the color orange?
No.
No. Actually, no, you don't go to jail unless you fail to pay the taxes and penalties that are a result from losing the tax-deferred status of your IRA. But just like a 1040 you know, the IRS is pretty good at accumulating taxes and penalties by not telling you they made a mistake until 3 years after you make it, and then they say you're subject to all these taxes and penalties because you didn't pay it back then.
It's probably a good bet that an investor that thinks they've thought of a bright idea probably hasn't, and the IRS has seen it 100 times already.
Well, not necessarily. There are lots of good ideas, and I could tell you a few stories there. But the thing is that, you know, through this book, for example, through our websites, through what we're developing as, you know, industry practices that will be available on our website at RITA, you know, we're getting out in front of the public. I mean, 2 or 3 years ago when I was out doing this more on the road, I think I did 104 presentations in 1 year.
Wow.
Telling the public about this stuff. So we're not trying to hide, you know, the good practices and how to stay out of trouble. We're actually emphasizing those things because we want people to have the opportunity to diversify and take advantage of their knowledge in a specific area for their advantage on their IRA portfolio. So going back to that theme, if you're good at real estate investing or you're a realtor and you're out picking properties all the time for your clients and you come across a really good deal, let's say an REO property, there's no reason why you can't use that knowledge to have your IRA purchase it. And we had a recent example down in Phoenix. Person used a realtor to buy an REO with their IRA at $56,000, then sold it retail in the afternoon at $85,000. By the way, that profit all comes back into the IRA on a tax-deferred basis, provided it was all cash.
And if it was a Roth, it'd be completely
tax-free. Well, as long as you wait until 59 and a half to tap it. But
what if his brother was the broker?
If the brother was a broker and they didn't get anything more than their normal fee for it, and there wasn't any quid pro quo back to the owner of the IRA that was the other brother,
mm-hmm.
that would probably be all right because the brother is not a disqualified person.
Okay. What's a
Barbara, if you're the broker and your IRA is doing the investment, you can't take a fee.
Okay.
You shouldn't even do the transaction. You should use some other broker you're not related to.
Okay. What is a prohibited transaction exemption, and how is it obtained?
Yeah. PTE or prohibited transaction exemption is a request that you submit to the Department of Labor anticipating the potential or even the reality of a prohibited transaction in advance of actually pursuing the transaction. And believe it or not, for reasons I can't even explain, there could be a scenario that would otherwise be something that I would stand in front of the public and say you absolutely cannot do, that for reasons I can't fathom, that the Department of Labor will exempt the individual from and allow them to pursue. Usually the exemption is on the basis that there is no increase in value or decrease in value as a result of the transaction. That is, it was being done at fair market value, and or that there aren't any other buyers for it or sellers or whatever that happens to be. But some lawyer is going to have to make a very strong case to substantiate those kinds of arguments. But they do grant them. Now, the problem is if you don't ask for it in advance of doing the transaction, even if you ask for it after you do it, they won't exempt it even if they would have if you had. Okay. You can follow that. You have to ask in advance. Otherwise, you just don't get the exemption.
Okay. And that's in writing? The exemption comes in writing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So the good day rule doesn't apply necessarily to that?
No, this is going to be a definitive yes or no.
Okay, glad to hear that. We only have 45 seconds left. I've heard some investors walking around with an IRA checkbook and buying houses. Is that?
Yes. Well, that's probably going to go by the way of the dodo bird. There are only two custodians, and Pensco being one, that will still do what are called checkbook IRAs.
Okay.
And the others that are members of the REITA Association will not do them at all, and that is where you have a single IRA as an owner of an LLC, and that's sort of what people are on the Internet are calling a checkbook IRA.
Okay. Tom, we're out of time.
Okay.
Give me your website, please.
Sure. www.penscotrust.com, and Pensco is P-E-N-S-C-O, trust.com.
Tom, we really appreciate you taking time. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.